Welcome to the Women Who Fights podcast. We empower female fighters to take full agency over their training. Our goal is to celebrate and inspire others with the incredible action women and allies are taking to level the playing field. We talk to experts, uncover prejudice, and champion what's driving our progress.
And today we have Kelly with us. Kelly is a PhD student studying the effects of menstrual cycle and hormonal contraceptive use on performance, recovery and adaptation in sports women. Kelly started a platform called Period of the Period with the goal to change the narrative for women's health and performance in sport and exercise through awareness, evidence-based education and support. This is what we love about her. So, Kelly, can you start by introducing yourself?
Yeah, so just touching on what you said there. Thank you, firstly, for inviting me on the podcast and eventually for getting around to scheduling this. It's been so much going backwards and forwards. But yeah, so as you said, I'm a PhD student at Northumbria University, and my main interests are focused on the female athlete, so specifically investigating the effects of the menstrual cycle and hormonal contraceptive use on performance recovery adaptation in sportswomen, like you've just said there. And to be totally honest, a PhD was never something that I'd even considered or even really knew much about until I was doing it and started it, and it was too late to go back then. But no, I've been incredibly lucky to have almost kind of fell into that research area, to be honest. But aside from that, I've always been someone who's had a keen interest in human physiology or kind of optimizing human performance, particularly in sport and exercise, and working with athletes or being that kind of team behind the team almost and supporting them. So as part of that, I completed an undergraduate degree in sport and exercise science, and that was followed by a master's in strength and conditioning as well. And they were both at Northumbria, so they haven't been able to escape me just yet. But also during my master's, I worked part-time as an S&C coach, so mainly providing S&C support to golfers. So that's my kind of sporting background, a lot different from fighting. But yeah, definitely was more of a golfer, but just play more for fun now. But I guess like most people, I got into this space because it was something that had an impact on my own health and my own sporting performance. And I realised then that actually there's a bit of a gap here or a huge need for all women and men to know more about this area. And then, like you mentioned there as well, alongside that research, also the founder of the Period of the Period, and that's basically a bit of an educational hub designed to change the narrative, like you said, for all women and girls in sport and exercise. So I guess I wanted to be part of the research to almost bridge that research gap that we have, but then also with the Period of the Period be able to share the kind of evidence-based information that I'm learning with all athletes, practitioners, coaches, etc. To help everyone, basically. So yeah, that's me in a bit of a whirlwind nutshell, really.
That's amazing. I mean, I think one of the problems is with scientific research is that the public very rarely get to actually see it, or if they do, understand it. I mean, I've read, me and Marina read research papers, and most of the time it takes me a while to Google words and unpick what they actually mean. So to have you as the bridge with Period of the Period, we want to definitely talk about Period of the Period because it's an incredible platform that you have. But before we get there, can we just talk a little bit about how you, did you cover like exactly how you got like onto your journey? What was the beginning of your journey? You were a golfer, is that correct?
Yeah, I played golf. That was my kind of sporting background. And then just through that, I kind of played at sort of that national level. So I was part of all the high performance like pathways as you kind of progressed through sport. And then I think it was being involved in that I noticed that gap within sort of female athletes and supporting them. Because a lot of the research and stuff we were doing, well, we trained with the boys and everything we did was the same as them. So I guess I've always had questions about my own sort of personal menstrual cycle, etc., but never really had the opportunity to learn about it until I was offered this kind of PhD role, and then dived fully into it since then. So yeah, 3 years did of they... learning, but yeah, it's been great.
Well, so did they just see that you had an interest in it and then offered you the PhD, or did you pursue it and go, actually, no, I want to do this?
Yeah, so my supervisor now, Kirsty, she kind of came to me and she was like, oh, we've got this PhD role that I know you'd be a good fit. I know you've got a research interest in that. And I just think it was just perfect timing, really. And I know I keep on saying I'm lucky, but obviously the work harder that I was interested in it as well. But yeah, no, it was just a bit of moment in time that I was in the right place at the right time. And yeah, fell into place.
You said that you were in the S&C field. I'm assuming you've met a lot of different trainers, and you've met a different variety of teaching styles, etc., etc. How many of those people had the menstrual cycle in mind when actually setting programs for their clients?
Yeah, so I'd probably say less than you would hope and less than you would imagine. I probably wouldn't be able to put an exact kind of figure or stat on it. Like, I wouldn't say the majority of coaches is something that they implement. But then also on the flip side of that, I think it's important that we all have an awareness and we all educated and know more about it. But at the same time, if you don't really need to address it with that athlete, and there's no point in bringing it up, and not everything needs to be periodized by menstrual cycle, hormone contraception for everyone. It's just kind of that individualized approach. But I definitely think more personal trainers, more S&C coaches, practitioners, researchers, everyone in the field needs to have that baseline education and level so that they can, if they need to work with an athlete, they can then do it. And yeah, I guess that's kind of where my kind of PhD led from there. So like I say, it was focused on menstrual cycle, hormone and contraception, so particularly oral contraceptive use, on performance, recovery, adaptation. But if I kind of break down the kind of studies that I did within that, so we basically started with this kind of systematic review and meta-analysis, which basically means we collected all the data that's been done so far in this area together to hopefully come to some kind of ultimate conclusion of what we know so far. And what we looked at there basically was the effect of the menstrual cycle firstly, and then the effect of oral contraceptive secondly on performance. So basically the rationale, like you say, is that athletes, practitioners, coaches, at the minute, we didn't really know whether exercise performance was affected by the menstrual cycle phase or not. And there was this general lack of consensus or lack of agreement. And because of that lack of agreement, there were no guidelines or evidence for sportswomen and those working with them to direct like performance training recovery, as you've just said there. But in terms of actually performance, these were the two first reviews with meta-analysis, which basically looked at this performance-based aspect across menstrual cycle and hormone and contraception and collected it all together. And hopefully that goal was to provide those practical recommendations. But if I kind of explain what we found, so basically this first study, like I say, looked at performance across the menstrual cycle, and we found 78 relevant studies. So we always say that it hasn't really been done so far, but there was quite a few there. I mean, it's not loads, but there was a few there, and that had data from over 1,000 participants. And the results basically indicated that exercise performance, so this is both strength and endurance performance together, was reduced by a trivial amount, so a very small amount, during the early follicular phase of the menstrual cycle compared to all other time points. So basically, exercise performance might be slightly reduced in some sportswomen, whilst your hormone levels, so estrogen, progesterone, are low, so usually during the days when you're bleeding, so on your period. But in addition to that, it's not always as simple as that. There was a very, very small effect, but in addition to that effect, we also showed lots of difference between the studies. So one study would report an effect, others didn't, and that might be down to things like research design, the participants included, the type of performance measured, whether it was strength or endurance. And then to go one step further, we also showed that a lot of the studies so far to date were actually considered low in quality. So I think off the top of my head, going back, it was like something like 42% were classified as low in quality, and only 8 or 10% were achieving that high quality status, which was quite a shock as well in terms of the quality of the research that we've got there. But basically, in summary, when you add all this together, so that really small effect size, the large difference between the studies and the poor quality, it meant that we couldn't provide those kind of exact guidelines on performing across your menstrual cycle for athletes, practitioners, researchers, etc. And instead, we recommend that this personalised approach is taken, and whereby you, like, so if you track your menstrual cycle, consider times when it might be reduced performance in the early follicular phase or enhanced performance at other times, but you shouldn't always assume that those average results kind of apply to you, is what we kind of go in. I'll take a breather for the oral contraceptive paper, or I'll just leave it there. I don't know what you want me to do.
I think, go on, tell us about the oral contraceptive paper as well.
Yeah. So basically, the oral contraceptive paper, that's where we compared the naturally menstruating with oral contraceptive users, but we also compared them with pill taking and pill free days as well. So obviously, you've got, generally speaking, most oral contraceptive users are on that combined type where you've got 28 days set up like a menstrual cycle with 21 pill taken, 7 pill free. So we wanted to compare that as well. And this time we found slightly less studies, so there's only 42 studies there. But the results generally indicated a trivial performance effect with oral contraceptive use. So basically, when compared to naturally menstruating women, oral contraceptive users might have a slightly reduced performance when taking their pill. Second to that, when we compared pill taking and pill free days, we found that performance was relatively consistent. So meaning that performance didn't change whether you were on your pill taking days or your pill free days. But again, a similar story in terms of that a large proportion of the studies were low quality. We only found that really small effect size, and there was differences between the studies again. So again, we recommended that you take that individualized approach to oral contraceptive use, focusing on the individual's response to their contraception, as some people will be affected and some people won't be affected at all. But yeah, that's kind of where my PhD started. And then we were looking at, like I just mentioned, their performance. So does performance on any given day change across the cycle? But then my last kind of couple of studies moved on to look at the effects on the likes of recovery, adaptation, or responses to training as well, because some of the research suggests so far that those could change across the cycle, but it hasn't really been investigated. But yeah, COVID kind of threw a bit of a spanner in the works with them ones. But yeah, we're getting there.
Are you working with high level athletes? Who's the people you're working with?
Oh, sorry. So these are all kind of active women. So the studies that I just talked about in terms of the performance, they were everything from just your recreational athlete into your elite level athlete. We grouped them all together, so that's another consideration to take there. But in terms of my actual studies where we've been in the labs researching, those are all just recreational and general active women, so not those at that elite performance level.
And with your page, Period of the Period, we've touched on it a little bit. Why did you start it? How is it received by everybody? I mean, I can only imagine positive, to be honest, because it's such an incredible page. But how was it received? And do you have, now it's evolved, did you expect what it to be, grow so much so quickly?
No, to be honest. So I started it really alongside my PhD, and it's kind of a bit of like what you say, that educational hub, that general place for knowledge, the latest research, any support on all those topics. So not just the menstrual cycle, hormone contraception, but things like breast health, pregnancy, menopause. And to be honest, it was something that I set up mainly for myself. So I was reading a lot of research papers and wanted somewhere to kind of collate them all together, break them down easily for me whilst I was writing my PhD and come back to it then. But that was during one of the first lockdowns in the UK for a few months. I was basically just talking to myself on this page, writing the research. But then it started to grow, and I couldn't actually believe how many women and girls were interested in the research and actually wanted that information and wanted to be able to access it easily and know more. So like you've mentioned before, I think research is not often easily accessible, or the transfer between research and the real world is often difficult. And I wanted to be able to kind of bridge that gap, so we all have access to the research that's available and it's easy to digest and implement if we need to. And then I guess we kind of grew from there. I keep saying we, but it's just me. But we grew to a podcast, and I've been incredibly lucky to speak with so many amazing experts, in this area. And early last year, we launched that, and that has 10 episodes. So a couple of bonus episodes as well. And like I say, we cover all those female-specific factors like hormonal contraception, menstrual cycles, breast support, even female-specific injuries, nutrition, menopause, etc. So yeah, if you're interested in learning more, we'd definitely direct you to them, because there are some incredible guests on there as well. And we've kind of now moved into like educational services as well. So deliveries of talks, presentations on in like schools, unis, sports clubs, organisations, which I absolutely love doing and get so much out of. So yeah, something that started as something really small and just myself has grown in such a short space of time and been, like you say, received really well, which is really nice.
So needed. It was so needed. What are your future plans from now on? Because you've now built your actual brand, like it or not, and it seems to be having a huge impact so far. So what? Where are you taking this?
Yeah, so great question. I guess at the moment, my total focus has kind of been on PhD and getting that last thing over the line. And as we've got closer to that, it has got a little bit quieter naturally on period of the period and what I've been posting and what I can do. But we've also actually just got some recent funding at Northumbria Uni, which is allowing me to stay on for that research project that we didn't get to finish for COVID, which is really exciting. So I'm in the midst of writing up a PhD and starting that as well. So there's little time for much else, but it's 100%. I absolutely love doing it, and we'll pick it back up as kind of soon as possible when I've got the time and when it's a bit quieter. And I do have high hopes and wishes, goals, etc., what I would like the platform to turn out and continue to grow and where I want to take it. So yeah, work slowly behind the scenes when I'm doing the PhD, but hopefully there'll be some new exciting stuff.
Well, Kelly, I think you're combining two really important aspects. So you've got the knowledge of the the research and the education back there, and then you've got the really good communication skills and knowing how to, you know, break that down something into digestible, really, really accessible layman's terms. And then these two are just yeah. Great.
No, that's lovely to hear. Thank you.
Have you always been supported throughout your research? It sounds like you've got a great university and a really great environment, but has there always been like, oh, this is a great idea, or has there been any challenges?
Yeah, so another good question. I guess I've never really thought about that before, which would kind of indicate that I am well supported. But yeah, no, like you say, I've been incredibly lucky to have gone to a university that I've absolutely loved and thoroughly enjoyed my time, both undergraduate and postgraduate. And it's ultimately, I guess, because of the people there that I got the PhD role, and then obviously this assistant researcher role as well. And I've got the most amazing group of supervisors and team around me. So Kirsty Hicks, and then you've got three incredible men. So Kev Thomas, Stu Goodall, and Paul Ansdell, who were all, well, he was starting his PhD at the same time in sex differences and taught me a lot about everything he knows, basically, and still definitely learning from them all today. And then also Kirsty Elliott-Sale, who's my external supervisor, who's basically the queen of female physiology research. So someone I really look up to, and I've just always felt supported by that great group as well. And I guess I know that the support's there in the future, and I'm so grateful for that as well. But in terms of actually doing the research, it is challenging. There are a lot of things to consider, from the likes of lack of funding, difficulty getting funding, recruitment of participants, and kind of just justifying why it's needed in the first place, sort of thing. But I guess ultimately the reason why I'm doing the research is to help support others. And I was chatting with a few people in this kind of research area, and they said it's so nice that women and girls want this information. So in the sense that you might be a researcher and study something for years and only a couple of people might be interested in it, but I'm so lucky to be involved in a research area that when you do this research, so many people are interested in it and want to know it, and it's going to make a big difference to lots of people. So it's a special time to be a part of it, especially when it's growing and evolving and when people are wanting to know more, and it's really coming to the forefront. So yeah, I hope that answers the question slightly.
Yeah, and you're growing it as well. You're helping the growth. Yeah. What I mean, you've touched on it a little bit, but is there anything else that you want to add on what are the challenges of female specific research? Any pushbacks?
Yeah,
any
yeah so Yeah, so I guess research on the female athletes to start with, kind of, we all know it falls way short of that carried out on men. So historically, this kind of lack of research in, well, women has been attributed to like the likes of historical guidelines and perception of women. So the sex bias in research dates as far back as like World War II, when medical trials were solely conducted on men. Sorry, I was going to say women there. And women were basically deemed as protected subjects at the time. So due to the fear that kind of any kind of clinical testing could potentially harm like unborn fetuses, etc. But I guess today, one of the most kind of frequently or commonly cited reasons for the exclusion of women is that we're perceived as too difficult to study or too time consuming or expensive, as we're more physiologically variable when it comes to men. So as you know, unlike men, we all have that kind of different hormonal pattern. So whether that means it's our menstrual cycle or differences across our lifespan with that, so our hormonal profile alters across our lifespan, and it can also be changed through hormonal contraception as well. So our physiology is different, and I guess that is, I'm not going to lie, it is a huge challenge. And when it comes to kind of doing the best quality research, you need to be able to get all those things right. So for instance, to be sure we know what our hormones are doing at that exact time we're testing, there's basically this three-step approach we have. So we basically get everyone to track their cycles for months before, so that adds a lot to the study. We basically use urinary ovulation detection kits and hormonal analysis, so you've got extra cost for that. And also, participants might not like you prodding them with a needle to take their blood every so often as well, so there's obviously a participation recruitment problem there. And I guess, like I say, they cost money, they cost training before you're even kind of let loose on a participant. So it takes a lot more timing, planning, organization, commitment, because we can't predict, for instance, when periods are going to happen. So you basically have to be at the beck and call of your participant. So there's a lot going on, and it's a totally different ball game to research in men, as when you think about it, you don't really need all this additional planning when it comes to them. Generally, they turn up on the day, and after one session, that's them kind of all done. So yeah, you can kind of see from that there are a lot of considerations for researchers when you're working in this area, and it might partly explain the reason for that current sex data, the gap that we've got. But having said that, we do all need to still strive to include women and girls in that research, and beyond this research as well, so that we can ultimately provide better support to them, despite how difficult or complex we might seem.
How do you normally conduct your research? Is it, you do it physically, do blood tests, take surveys? What are the different ways that you do it?
Yeah, so I guess before, like, kind of COVID hit, it was a lot different to what it is post that. So for instance, before, we were looking at the effects of menstrual cycle hormone and contraception on recovery following a training session. So for that, the participants were in the labs, they were doing a heavy leg press training session and fatiguing them, and then we're also testing them for their recovery. So we followed them up at 24, 48, 72 hours post, and repeated that at different times in the menstrual cycle or the oral contraceptive pill cycle. And then basically to look at the recovery, we had lots of different, I keep saying sciencey measures and it makes me sound not very sciencey at all, but basically sciencey measures where we're basically zapping them on the brain to look at neuromuscular fatigue, as well as muscle biopsies. So taking small chunks of muscle from the thigh to look at the likes of satellite cell responses, regeneration. And we also, like I just mentioned there, applied all the standards of bloods, urinary ovulation detection kits. But because of COVID, obviously that was all shut down, and it was kind of such a shame because it was just starting to get going, and then it took a lot of work and hoops to jump through to get biopsies, etc. But yeah, as people were just signing up, we got shut down. But going back to the question, we've developed a different kind of home-based study from that, and we adapted a lot of it, and it was a lot less sciencey, that word again. So of course it was at home, so we didn't have the neuro measures, the biopsies, the blood, but we did the best we could do in that possible situation. And I still believe it's actually a really interesting study that it's a lot more relatable, and just generally, like, kind of from a science perspective and someone interested in it, I think they seem, in my eyes, interesting papers to read. But it did also have its positives. So on the flip side, recruitment is often really hard in this area. But recruitment for this home-based study was amazing, whether that was because it was online or, and it was a lot less needy for participants and that they didn't have to constantly be in the labs. And we had such a great take-up on it, which was amazing that so many women actually wanted to participate in this research. And actually, there was so much nice feedback saying how interesting it was to be a part of it and how much they learned from their own bodies, which was great to hear as well. So yeah, if you're wanting to get involved in any research, I definitely encourage you to have a little look and help reduce that sex data gap we have.
Absolutely. We are all for it. You, of course, just send it our way. You contributed to the paper, Invisible Sportswomen. And it was the sex data gap in sport and exercise research. I don't remember all of it. Would you like to tell us a little bit about that? What was that about? What did you find?
Yeah, 100%. So, as I mentioned, like historically, inequalities have existed in the inclusion of women participating in exercise. So, for example, if we kind of, without making it history chat, if we go all the way back to the 1800s, at the time, sort of scientists cautioned women against physical activity with concerns that any kind of physical effort, whether it was like running, jumping, whatever it might be, might damage our female reproductive organs or even make us unattractive to men. And this view was also echoed within the elite sports environment. So if you think about it, the first participation in the Olympic Games was men only. But as we've kind of progressed from that, the sportswoman has gradually become more of an accepted part of sport and exercise, and we've had that biggest rise in the number of women in physical activity and sport in the last kind of 3 to 5 decades. So if you were to specifically look at kind of elite sport, the percentage of women competing at the Olympic Games, I was going to say this year, but last year, has increased from 26% in 1988 to an all-time high of 49% in Tokyo. So because more women are participating in sport and exercise, whether that's at an elite level or a recreational level, we as athletes, practitioners, coaches, researchers, we have to know more about female physiology and how that might be influencing sports performance, training, recovery. Because just like male athletes, we all want to get faster, stronger, achieve PBs, whether that's kind of at just a recreational level or that world-class gold medal performance as well. But despite the number of women partaking in sport increasing and the need to know more about female physiology, research still falls way short of that done on men. So in the most recent paper by Costello et al., which was in 2014, the authors highlighted that in the top-ranked sports science and medicine journals, only 4 to 13% of the research was done exclusively on women, so which meant that whilst research on women was not keeping pace with the kind of rise in participation. So basically, we wanted to kind of do an updated study on this kind of Costello paper, basically. And when I say we, it was the lead author, Emma Cowley. So she's a PhD student at Liverpool John Muir, and I actually met her because she participated in my home-based study, which was amazing. And then Emma Ross and Alyssa as well, who's another PhD student in America, looking at female-specific research as well. And she's, they're all incredible. But basically what we did is, like I say, we did this updated study of this Costello paper. So we searched for all the papers from 2014 to 2020. And the results revealed that only 6% of the research was done exclusively on women, and that only 34% of total participants were females as well. So you can see that not much has really changed from that Costello paper, and females do remain significantly underrepresented, which means that at the minute, conclusions made from this data might still not be only applicable to men or male athletes, and researchers and practitioners need to be aware of that and also need to address it kind of as soon as possible, really. But also, interestingly, we also explored a little bit deeper than the paper by Costello, and we looked at research titles. So for this, basically, we found that there's a sex difference also in research titles. So 63% of female studies included that in the title, so it would say like done on women or in women active women, etc., whereas only 14% of male studies were doing this. And although that sounds like not a big issue at all, ultimately the research title, it's the first thing you see, it's the first thing you'd be able to identify if the outcomes are relevant to you and applicable to both sexes, rather than just having it hidden the methods basically. So we need that information straight away. And then another thing we looked at was basically what each of these research studies were investigating. And what we found was that the majority of male-only studies were not really investigating a sex-specific topic. So only 0.6% of the research was looking at this male-specific topic, which means that 99.4% of them actually could have included women, which is crazy, really, when you think about it. And also, I guess, in terms of, we looked at why we might have this kind of research gap, and it's all the reasons we've kind of touched on so far in the podcast. So from less funding for women, or even things like women holding less ranked academic positions or editor positions in journals. So do women study women and men study men, for instance? Or is this research considered important enough to get into high impact journals, etc.? So yeah, it was such a privilege to be a part of that paper, and I'd encourage everyone to go and read it and check it out, because it is free to download if you would like.
That's great. Mm. What do you think we should be doing to change the narrative and, you know, have more female specific research out? What are the tangible things that we must be doing to bring about more knowledge around periods, menopause, because that's a grey area and that's a scary area as well. What can be done from your amazing platform?
No, how can we help? Great question. Yeah, I don't even know where to start with this, but I guess kind of going back to like the core roots of the paper, I think we do need that increased funding for female specific research in sport and exercise science, and maybe even more women involved in this area. And I'm by no means saying male researchers aren't interested or not doing a good enough job, far from that. In fact, like I just mentioned, the majority of people on my team are men as well, and I'm incredibly lucky to work with them, but it would be nice to have more women researching in this area as well. And then I guess we need to work harder to encourage girls and women to get involved in research and find new ways of supporting research, because for a lot of women taking part in a study like mine, it's kind of a massive time commitment. And we know that women do the most unpaid work in terms of work outside of work, like caregiving. So say if you're a mum who also works a full-time job and has all those additional roles to fulfil on top of that, then when are you going to find time to dedicate to a study? So I think as researchers, we need to find new ways around it and get kind of creative and innovative how we do that. And if anyone has any ideas, I'd love to know. But then obviously education as well. So it's not just the lack of research into women's health and performance that's the issue. There's also a massive lack of awareness, which can be attributed to the fact that for a long time women's health and education has been kind of hushed up and not considered or thought of as a taboo, basically. So what it means is most of us have grown up uneducated or even ashamed about our bodies, like especially periods, menstrual cycle and other factors, like we wouldn't even really consider like breast health, pelvic floor health, etc. And I guess that is slowly improving, but we do need to strive for that increased education in this area. And having kind of that appropriate sort of awareness, proper introduction to our female physiology will stop and help us from that as well. But I think one kind of easy place that we can all kind of start right away is to talk more about all these topics. So have conversations, spread the word, because I guess ultimately the more we do that, the more we normalize the area and it becomes a normal conversation. And the more we do that, the more we can help all women and girls not only kind of achieve their kind of top sporting performance and training levels, but also just develop that lifelong love for sport and physical activity as well. So yeah, I'm not sure there was many ideas in that, but hopefully by just talking about it, we can start.
Are there any other studies that you have been involved in or that you know of that you want to talk about?
Yeah, so I guess we kind of covered all of my research studies so far, but hopefully that from kind of the ones we've done in the home-based COVID, the last couple of studies that I'm writing up at the moment will be of interest and out there very soon. It's just writing them, getting them all finished, and hopefully that'll provide some information as well to women and girls and those working with them to help them achieve further their performance and training goals. And they're more focused on kind of perceived recovery and the links with symptoms and how that might influence performance and training as well. So there are some interesting findings in that. And I guess for anyone kind of interested in learning more about the research, I do constantly try to share all the kind of new studies in the area on Period of the Period and research opportunities to get involved with is there. So if you are, have a look out on them. But at the minute, I've got no other studies that I haven't talked about.
That's fine. What are your long-term career plans? Where do you see yourself in a 5-10 years? Yeah, that's like an interview question, but
it is.
That's a real interview question.
I guess, like I mentioned at the start, I'm currently trying not to think kind of beyond my PhD too much. It's a little scary, but I'm mainly focused on getting that complete. But of course, I'm lucky to be staying in that area a little bit further with the research role as well. And then hopefully I'd love to stay beyond that into the future. And also on the side of that, I'd love to see Period of Period continue to grow. And I do have some exciting plans for the project that we've kind of talked about. But yeah, my main priority right now is getting the PhD over the line and focus on this new research role as well. But I guess I'm really kind of always been someone that focused on the now and the present and being the kind of doing the best I possibly can at that moment in time. Yeah. And then hopefully it might open doors and create opportunities as we
absolutely.
I don't doubt that.
Was lockdown? Did it pause your work in any, like, or did it just make it more difficult?
Yeah, a bit of both, really. So I was due to actually finish my PhD October last year, but we got an extension because we were basically out of the labs for about, a year, really. So we kind of stopped researching from a lab-based perspective in the hope that we'd be back there in 3 months, but 3 months came and went, and we still went back there. So we had to kind of adapt the study to be able to continue and get my PhD and through that. So that's where the kind of home-based question came from. And like I say, it went from being kind of like really science measures like the biopsies and the neuromuscular measures to more of a perceived effect. So do you feel more recovered? How fatigued? Do you feel muscle soreness in the days post? But also linking a lot with menstrual cycle symptoms. And there were some interesting findings there as well in terms of the impact of symptoms on your performance and potential links there. And also the impact of symptoms on your ability to recover and respond to training as well. So yeah, it's still novel and new, but it's just a little bit different. But luckily with this kind of new research grant, we do get to explore that original research question as well, so it didn't all go to waste. So hopefully we've got that kind of more perceived perceptual element, and we can tie it in with the more physiological element, so it's kind of given us a more well-rounded sort of perspective as well, which is exciting.
Amazing. Marina, do you have any more questions that you want to ask Kelly before we move on to our final?
I think that's it for now, but we need to keep in touch with Kelly because she's doing an amazing job in spreading awareness on a very, very important matter. So you can go in for the last
Kelly,
question.
So, Kelly, we're going to ask our final question we ask all of our guests, which is, and this is just a general question about your sort of, you can take it however you want to take it. You interpret it how you like. But what are you fighting for?
I guess at the minute, my personal fight is to get through these final few months of writing and not go into mini meltdowns every time I think about it. But also, I think I'm fighting for what exactly you are both fighting for as well, and that we want every woman to feel educated or empowered in their training and performance, and they can do and be whatever they kind of want to be. So yeah, I suppose that's a nice question to finish, actually. Wasn't expecting that one.
Well, thank you so much for your time. That was beautiful. You loaded so much information on there. That was amazing. Thank you.
It's really good.
No, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Women Who Fight podcast. And credit to Will Grant for being our songwriter and sound editor. Please subscribe and share and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at womenwhofight.co.uk and check out our website for more content.